may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the Court, John McIntyre on behalf of the appellant, Capital Foundry of Virginia. Your Honor, as indicated in our brief, the issue before the trial court...
Let me let you know that microphone is not primarily for amplification. It's for recordation. So you're going to have to speak up a little bit more.
Yes, sir.
For my all of us to hear you.
My allergies have been bothering me. It makes my voice a little froggy. My apologies for that. Your Honors, as the record indicates, and as it's set forth in our briefs, the issue before the trial court was a relatively straightforward one. That is, the trial court was charged under 13.1, 749.1 with determining the fair value of Ms. Jimenez's stock in Capital Foundry as of December 31, 2013. That was the valuation date set by the court under that statute. The evidence was undisputed that prior to this court's October 31, 2014 opinion, in related litigation, what the parties called a shareholder agreement litigation, the value of Capital Foundry was $7.642 million. The evidence was also undisputed.
Can I interrupt you there?
Yes, sir.
But at that very moment, there was a contingent liability. There was the shareholder agreement unliquidated liability, and evaluator has to come up with some model, and GAAP and other regimens have ways of doing this to estimate that liability. So this evaluator came to trial months later after the opinion and said, here's my best estimate. Isn't it just an expert evaluation question and a preponderance sufficiency appeal?
I would respectfully suggest, Your Honor, that it's not, for two reasons. First, with regard to the expert's opinion, while it's true that in valuation cases, typically an evaluator will try and estimate contingent liabilities, there is a point when that can't happen, when there are so many variables, when it is so uncertain that estimating becomes nothing more than guesswork. And that was Mr. Baum, who was Capital Foundry's expert's testimony, was that...
Is that your main argumental appeal, that the valuation expert's testimony went beyond reasonable forecasting into inadmissible speculation?
It's 2 points, Your Honor. First, and this goes to the second point I was about to raise in response to Your Honor's question. The trial court's opinion, at least the comments of the trial court, are not that, well, Mr. Timms over here valued the shares at $328,000 apiece, and therefore I'm going to go with that. What the trial court said in her comments was that I'm reading this October 31, 2014 opinion. And what she says, Your Honor, and I'll simply quote, part of the issue here is those 30.6 shares, and I was looking through here again. The Supreme Court, in their decision, made it pretty clear that those 30.6 shares were not just sitting out there waiting for someone to come along. And so, in my mind, in using them in a calculation to figure out the value of the outstanding shares, according to the Supreme Court, they're basically not outstanding shares anymore. Your Honor, an interpretation of one of these court's opinions, this court's opinion, is a question of law. And the trial court's comments are that she interpreted this court's October 31, 2014 opinion to say those shares are gone. She didn't rely then on expert estimates or valuations, if you will. What she did is she took the undisputed value of the company as
but
of December
31. Judges, myself included, will sometimes use hyperbole when we're trying to describe our thinking process, but in the end, appellate courts don't fix on isolated remarks of judges from the bench. Fix on the evidence and the actual holding of the case. The holding matches the evidence, the expert's testimony. Why isn't that enough to turn our face away from an arguable overgeneralization?
Because, Your Honor, and I would suggest again, as this court's indicated in Vasquez and any number of other cases, an expert cannot purely speculate. And to put it in an easier, out-of-context example, if I could. In a breach of contract action for a purchase of a house, an appraiser can come in and value the house as of December 31, 2013, at $250,000, based in part on the fact that the house next door, which was substantially similar, sold 2 months after the valuation date for $250,000. There's nothing wrong with using a subsequent event to try and support valuation. That same appraiser could not permissibly come into court, I would again respectfully suggest, and argue that the house is worth $250,000 because the house next door was listed for $250,000. And he just assumes it's going to sell for that.
Well, put differently, how does the trial court's statements or ruling, if you want to call it that, impact this expert's opinion on valuation?
The ruling on valuation, Your Honor, and that goes to our third point on appeal, is our position is it was error to allow the expert to testify as to what was referred to at trial as his second opinion. That is, that the company was worth $7.642 million before this court ruled. But after this court ruled, you have to back out those 30.6 shares and the purchase price for those 30.6 shares under the shareholder agreement. In doing so, what the expert did is determine that only one of a myriad of possible outcomes would occur with 100% certainty and then apply that retroactively.
No, it doesn't have to be 100% certainty. It's a forecast. These numbers are, experts are using these numbers quite liberally in estimating. It's not, no one's claiming certitude. Preponderance is 51% convincing, and that's all the expert has to show.
Your Honor, I would, again, respectfully suggest, I think for the court is a preponderance of the evidence. For an expert, what the case law says is that an expert has to take into account all relevant facts and circumstances.
Does it have to have 100% certitude to give an opinion?
No, Your Honor, but the expert could have and should have estimated the probability. Again, going back, and this is the problem Justice Holmes describes in Ithaca Trust, using hindsight to create a value, that is to say, using what we know now, pushing it back, in this case, 10 months, really up to 2 years, and saying, well, that definitively determines the value, is simply improper. Had Mr. Timms come in and said, well, there are one of three possibilities. Mr. Carr can buy it, under this court's opinion. Ms. Jimenez could buy it, under this court's opinion, or the company will buy it. And if the company buys it, I think there's a very good likelihood that it will be able to pay for it, which means the stock doesn't revert back because it is collateral for the note. And I think it is unlikely. Those two will agree. And using all of my best efforts and experience, I estimate it at a 60% chance that it will be the company that buys. That would be an opinion which at least theoretically would have some basis. In fact, would there be some forecasting? Sure. But, Your Honor, the problem, and the problem this court gets into and is enunciated on a number of occasions, is the same one you face if I'm suing for fraud in the inducement on a startup. This court has held time and time again, I can't have lost future profit or lost future value of business if I don't have a track record. And why? Because that estimate is nothing more than guesswork.
I may have completely misunderstood what this expert did, but tell me why this is not correct. The issue before us in the first case was whether the shareholders' agreement should have been used to value the stock. Correct?
It was more, as I under the issue in the shareholder agreement litigation, Your Honor, was whether or not the estate planning documents of Ms. Norma Carr, who has since passed away and was a majority shareholder, took precedence over the shareholders' agreement, which was subsequently executed.
Right. Argument being the shareholders' agreement should have been used to value the stock.
It wasn't so much a valuation issue, Your Honor, as a who-gets-to-buy issue. Under the estate planning documents, Mr. Carr, the son, had an option to purchase mm-hmm. as much of the company as he wanted to.
At
the
what
fact
price?
At
there was a question of what the price was to be.
It was formula-driven, but...
It was formula-driven. And so if the question is, as of December 31st, 2013, what was the value of the stock, and it was formula-driven, why wouldn't the same formula that decided the 64.4 shares be the formula that would decide the rest of the estate stock, the 95. And so he said, as I understood his testimony, the 64.4 shares, using the formula, were valued at X. And now I'm going to use that same formula to value the remainder of the estate's shares.
The difficulty with that, Your Honor, is, first, there's nothing wrong with the math associated with that. I would agree that the shareholder agreement is what determines the purchase price per share for those 30.6 shares held by the estate. There's no question about that, and there's no dispute about that. The issue is that because that purchase price is roughly $80,000 per share less than the pro rata value of the company as of December 31, 2013, simply pulling those 30.6 shares out of the outstanding balance and pulling the contingent liability out of the existing balance means that you increase the value of the remaining shares by roughly 75%. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty is this, Your Honor. If the shares were purchased by Mr. Carr, then they don't go away. There would still have been 40.6 shares outstanding. And the value of the company would then have been $7.642 million, which means the value of the shares would have been $188,000 per share.
But that hypothesis requires the assumption that everyone would agree. And if there's one thing you can infer from this file and the earlier file, there's not a lot of agreement going on.
That may be, Your Honor, but there was no, in fact, the expert was prohibited from speculating as to whether the parties would agree. But I would suggest that's not the end of the analysis.
But if the parties don't agree, the corporation redeems the stock.
The corporation has the obligation to redeem the stock. There would be nothing stopping the corporation.
So the court's holding was the corporation has a contractual obligation, as do all of the participating shareholders, to have the stock redeemed. Now, if they want to get together and decide among themselves differently, that's fine. That's a new contract. But this contract, according to our opinion, held the corporation has a contractual obligation and the estate of the participating shareholder had a contractual duty to offer the stock for redemption. Well, that's what happened.
That is, Your Honor, but at the time of trial, that's not what happened.
Well, the expert was projecting it. I don't want to argue with you, but I'm not understanding you. It seems to me the expert's saying, I think that's what, in my reasonable use of my evaluation expertise, I think that's the most probable answer. And in fact, it turned out to be true after the fact, of course. But why is that inadmissible as a matter of speculation?
I would suggest, Your Honor, that the expert would have to at least consider other possibilities. And more importantly, the one thing that no one considered, and the trial court even said is irrelevant, is whether the company, if it's the one who buys, can afford to pay for it. And that's a big if, Your Honor. If the company defaults on this note, then these, not just the 30.6 shares, all 95 shares revert back to the estate. And now all of a sudden there's 105 shares outstanding. Your Honor, the other point I would make is this. As we indicate in our brief, under the shareholders' agreement, the company's rights, just like any contract, are assignable as long as the acquisition would be by another permitted shareholder. A company gets no benefit for buying its stock. It can't hold its own stock. It's redeemed. It's money that's basically lost. Your Honor, at some point, there has to be some level of certainty. I would again suggest, before the court can simply say, well, I'm going to go with this expert who just assumes that this set of facts is going to happen, there has to be a balancing. There has to be a consideration.
Was there evidence that future insolvency risk was of a magnitude that the promissory note was in jeopardy of being fulfilled?
I'm sorry, sir?
Was there any evidence that in future insolvency would put the promissory note in jeopardy?
There is evidence, I will say. It was not argued to the court, Your Honor, because, and again, our feeling from the corporate side is that that, too, gets into something that's too speculative. I don't know how the company will do next year, the year after that. The company's down. Its gross sales were down by $1 million last year. But, Your Honor, the fact that the company's now the buyer, I would respectfully suggest, is just as irrelevant as me coming in here and saying, well, the company's gross sales are down by $1 million. The tax return for 2011, which was in evidence, shows that the company had gross sales of $3 million a year that year. The officer comp was $1 million. The rest of it was operating expenses down to around $300,000. The obligation under this note exceeds $1 million a year.
And in theory, the fact finder could have said, you know what, that causes me a lot of anxiety as to the confidence this expert's been given, and I'm not going to accept it. But that's not what the fact finder apparently did.
I would agree, Your Honor, but I would suggest under Vasquez, in similar cases, the fact that the fact finder did not at least consider, and the expert did not consider, that possibility.
Well, I thought you're talking about Tim's testimony, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And at JA 304 through 310, Tim's talks about ability to repay, assuming repayment, possibilities of default.
Your Honor,
did I misunderstand what you just said?
Your Honor, he talks about the fact that the company has, at that juncture, little debt and a considerable amount of assets. He does not describe what those assets are. But, Your Honor, at JA 304 and 306, he specifically says he does not know whether the company can make the payments. At 305, he says he didn't even calculate the payment amount. And at 305 and 306, he says that he doesn't even know what the interest rate is on the note. The court's comments were simply
in
that.
In those same pages, he says he assumes repayment, and then later at 310, he says when the company redeems its own stock, the stock is considered issued but not outstanding, and it doesn't. The possibility of default doesn't impact that, and Capital Foundry's expert witness doesn't refute that practice in valuation, right?
Your Honor, I didn't read, I apologize if I misread that. I did not read his testimony to be that he was testifying the company can repay the note. If he did, it's inconsistent with his statement that he doesn't know whether the company
can. Well, he doesn't
can.
Say they can. He says he assumes it for purposes of his evaluation. And then he says it doesn't impact it regardless of the possibility of default. And Capital Foundry's expert didn't argue with that. I mean, it all of these arguments that you're making come down to a battle of the experts, it seems to me. And they all say they used standards of appraisers in this particular situation. So it sounds like to me that you want us to say as a matter of law this particular standard of valuation isn't acceptable. Is that right?
Not exactly, Your Honor. I think it goes to two points. First, I think it goes to the level to which an expert can speculate, which this court has opined on in the past. And there are certain levels where assumptions are so unsupportable or unsupported that they're simply not permissible. The second thing is this, Your Honor. The opinion is not so much, unless the opinion is purely of Mr. Timms that, well, I just think the company's going to buy. Everything else is simply math. He says, well, it's 30.6 shares, which is undisputed. That's not an expert opinion. That's simply how many shares are held by the estate. And he multiplies that 30.6 by 108 and change, which is the purchase price under the shareholder agreement, giving the $3 million plus in purchase price for those 30.6 shares. The only conclusion he has are, one, what the value of the company is, which is what we stipulated to as of December 31, 2013, and two, his conclusion that, as he puts it, this court's opinion requires that you back out those shares from the outstanding shares and you back out the purchase price and you do it retroactively to December 31, 2013. And I would suggest...
That's the answer to your question. All right. Thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Baumgartner on behalf of Nancy Jimenez in this case. The case involves the valuation of Capital Foundry as of December 31, 2013. And part of that determination involved what were the rights and obligations, liabilities of the company as of December 31, 2013. And as Justice Kelsey noted, there was a disputed liability at that point in time. The disputed issue was whether the shareholders' agreement controlled the disposition of the estate's shares. Now, that event, all of the events had occurred. The shareholders' agreement had been signed. Mrs. Norma Carr had passed away in 2012. And so the events giving rise to the party's legal obligations had all occurred. The question was, there was a dispute about that liability at that point in time. And Mr. Timms testified, unrebutted by Mr. Ball.
Let me ask you, But the dispute about the liability would be considered in determining the value of the property, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be something that would be considered in coming up with that $7 million number?
Yes, Judge. Justice. I apologize. Justice Goodwin, the question is, who makes that determination at what point in time? And what Mr. Timms testified to is that it's standard practice, if there's a disputed liability, if it's feasible to wait and see if that dispute can be resolved in a timely fashion in order to complete the valuation. So in other words, his first opinion was $7.6 million without factoring in this disputed liability. He also testified that if necessary, if the court had asked to do that, he could have weighed the probabilities of the various outcomes. But in this case, the court decided, certainly the court could, if the Supreme Court had not been considering the issue of the shareholders' agreement at that very point in time, and one significant issue was whether this shareholder agreement applied, the court could have made that determination as part of the determination of the liabilities. It could have said, shareholders' agreement applies, and therefore make your valuation based upon that.
I'm going to stop you for just for a second, because I guess the question I have is, when you say the shareholders' agreement applies, isn't the problem that, pursuant to the shareholders' agreement, we don't know who's going to buy the stock? Because it doesn't say the company has to buy it, there's also a chance that a shareholder could buy it. Isn't that where the rub comes in with this whole thing?
It is a condition. However, it doesn't impact the valuation in this case for a couple of reasons. First of all, there was a redemption agreement done in late 2012 whereby the 64.4 shares were purchased for the 303 redemption. That redemption agreement is in evidence. It's Exhibit 3. And in that redemption agreement, the parties agreed that if a final determination of a court was that the shareholders' agreement applied, then the redemption agreement would be modified to conform to the shareholders' agreement. So the company was going to purchase all of the shares. That was the agreement that was in place. I think this court's ruling certainly allowed open, and in any time when all of the parties to an agreement agreed to change it, the parties could have agreed to change that.
Can I interrupt you mid-sentence? Tell me if I'm reading it right. Section 3 of the agreement is titled Mandatory Sale and Purchase of Stock, and it says the agreeing shareholder shall offer the stock, and it, quote, shall be purchased by the company. Right? So, of course, if everyone gets together and agrees to do a new contract other than that language, then the contract allows for that.
If the parties agree.
But so the contractual default is, no, it's going to, you got to buy it. You got to redeem the stock. Now, if you guys get together and decide otherwise, that's fine. I just want to make sure I'm not reading it incorrectly.
I believe you're reading from Section 3 of the Shareholders Agreement.
Right.
Section 3 of the Shareholders Agreement is, I believe, on death or disability, and it was either the remaining shareholders or the corporation can buy. And that was the holding of this court in the shareholder agreement litigation.
Right. My only point is there seems to be a default. It says, on death of agreeing shareholders, all shares of stock owned by the agreeing shareholder shall be sold by the personal representative and shall be purchased by the corporation.
The
remaining shareholders can buy it. Well, so the default is you got to buy it. Now, if you guys get together and want to buy it, that's fine.
I agree that at the time that the trial court heard this, that was the situation. The corporation had contracted to purchase inconsistent with the shareholders' agreement. And the court said if the parties agree otherwise, then they can agree otherwise. The testimony in front of the trial court was, as Justice Kelsey noted earlier, there seems to be very little agreement in this case. But the right to agree was part of the value that was in Nancy Jones'
Counsel, doesn't 3A also establish the purchase price for all 95 of the estate shares? It establishes, pursuant to paragraph 4, what the purchase price is going to be.
Yes, Justice Powell, and that's really the crux of the testimony of Mr. Timms, because taking a $7.6 million valuation under the company's position in this case, The value of each share as of December 31, 2013 is $188,000.
And so it says they shall buy it, and they shall buy it at this price.
Correct, at $108.
Right.
So those shares were spoken for at a lower price. And I think that what Mr. Timms' testimony showed and what the trial court in this case found persuasive was that if you account for the sale of those other shares that had to be bought by the company at a fixed price of $108,000, Nancy Jimenez and Jim Carr were at that point each held five shares. They each were equal shareholders. And by valuing Mrs. Jimenez's shares at $1.6 million, the remaining five shares were worth exactly the same, $1.6 million. And to do anything else, to do what's suggested by Capital Foundry here and purchase Nancy Jimenez's shares for less than $1 million, would simply shift that value to Jim Carr. And the court found no reason to suggest that Mr. Carr's five shares were worth any more than Mrs. Carr's. Mrs. Jimenez's five shares.
Counsel, there's another aspect of the valuation of the shares and with regard specifically to a liability that I'm concerned about. And I would draw your attention to page 5 of your brief,
yes,
footnote 3. I'm going to get a little bit into the weeds.
Yes, Justice.
You referenced the court's imposition of terms from the order in October 31st, 2014. And footnote 3 describes those terms. But that document isn't before us in this litigation. And it is, in fact, in the other litigation, which would involve different parties, and I don't know that we can go find that in the circuit court's file and bring it into this particular record. But presuming that your statement is accurate and it has not been disputed by your opposing counsel, and presuming that the corporation that Capital took that particular order of the court and went the entire 60 months paying at exactly the rate that the court ordered it to pay, that 3.25% interest factor is a liability. And just my back-of-the-envelope calculation would indicate that that liability is many hundreds of thousands of dollars if, in fact, the note is paid back over 5 years. I don't see where that liability was considered by Mr. Timms. And if it wasn't, then it dramatically changes the per share value. Can you respond to that, please?
Yes. The valuation was done just as the interest factor on accounts payable are not factored in, because it's the time value of money that is being accounted for with that interest factor, such that the company has this obligation, and the fact that it's taking time to pay that obligation, it can, in the meantime, use money for other purposes. And so the liability at that point in time, as of December 31st, 2013, unless the interest rate is beyond market, in other words, there's additional value there. But the interest on accounts receivable, which generates income to the company, the interest on accounts payable are not factored into the evaluation as a specific date, as a matter of course.
This is neither an account receivable nor an account payable. This is a note where the court superimposed terms. That's my question. Would that not be a liability?
It is a liability, and Mr. Timms valued that liability the way an expert values that liability. Now, there was no suggestion that his valuation of that liability was incorrect.
I didn't see anything in the record indicating where that liability was factored in. I'm so far into the weeds that I don't think it would be fair to say, show me where in the joint appendix that appears. But that is a concern. That it's an incorrect valuation that the court then accepted.
Justice Mims, Mr. Timms evaluated what the liability would be in accordance with valuation standards. That's what he testified to. That was not challenged. Certainly, the company could have, through its expert, come in and said, no, you didn't value that liability correctly because of the interest rate factor that you should have included in that. But that was unrebutted by Mr. Timms, and I would submit that given the opportunity, Mr. Timms could have rebutted that by testifying that if it's a market rate, it's not 25% interest, but if it's a market rate interest, then it doesn't affect the valuation because there's the corresponding time value of money.
You've answered my question. Thank you.
I thought what Mr. Timms in essence did was took the valuation that he had before, took out the 30.6 shares of stock, and then just divided the remaining valuation, once paying for that, divided the remaining valuation by the remaining number of shares of stock to get his number, right?
Yes, Justice Goodman. He went one other step, though. What he did was, after this court's decision that the shareholders' agreement applied, he went back to the shareholders' agreement and to the redemption agreement and recalculated the entire 95 shares because the first 64.4 were actually purchased at a lower price. So it wouldn't have been fair not to account for that entire liability. He went back and he calculated the liability of the 95 shares, gave credit for the payment that had been made,
right,
which is $5.9 million,
right,
and then valued what the remaining liability was for the remaining.
So where does he figure in the liability that Justice Mims was talking about? I don't see that in his calculation at all.
Because the company had prepaid, the $5.9 million was applied, so there was no interest accruing on that amount. They had already prepaid $5.9 million. The future payment of interest...
That has already happened?
Yes. The $5.9 million payment was made back in 2013. The calculation of interest of a liability on the books of the company was considered as part of Mr. Timms' valuation. Again, it may not be an account payable, but there's accounts payables are liabilities, accounts receivables are monies coming in. All of those might have interest factors in them, but that interest factor is the time value of money.
So which is relevant.
It is relevant, and he considered that. The way he calculated the present value of that was not challenged, and I submit that if it was challenged, that he would have been able to explain his methodology on valuing those.
Let me ask you one other question, because this is important. When we go to the, to me anyway, the shareholders agreement, and we look at paragraph 3, and it basically says upon death that the shares shall be purchased by the company or the remaining shareholders. I guess I see those as the word or meaning exactly what it says. It says the company or the remaining shareholders can purchase it. Not that the company's got to buy it, and if they don't, the shareholders can buy it. It's saying either one of them can buy it. So how does one determine? It seemed like to me you were saying there has to be some agreement that the shareholders buy it. Why is that? As opposed to the company doing it.
Well, first of all, Justice Goodwin, the redemption agreement that was entered into by the parties in 2012 in November, governing the 64.4 shares, at that point in time, the parties agreed that if the court ultimately held that the shareholders' agreement applied, then the note that in connection with that redemption agreement would be written to conform to the shareholders' agreement, i.e. the company was then going to buy all 95 shares. This court's ruling, however, said, my time has expired, may I finish the response?
Please.
This court's ruling in October 31st as to how the shareholders' agreement operates was that in the first instance, the parties should try to agree on the proportions, but if they could not agree, then the company must purchase. That was the ruling.
You said that's in our opinion?
Yes, Justice. Okay. And so that was the default provision at that point. Thank you.
Your time has expired. The court has three more cases on its docket. We will resume our deliberations here in our hearings at 11:20.